From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's start our week in review by going all the way back to 2004. That's when an Illinois state senator named Barack Obama gave a speech at the Democratic National Convention that launched his political career.
Obama talked about the divisions in our country and how to bridge the gaps, and one of our conversations this week brought his speech in 2004 to mind. We sat down with first-generation college students who shared their struggles and successes with us. One of the students was Bernard Rogers, who told us that when he was thinking about going to college, there was a social cost for him.
First, let's listen to what Barack Obama said about this issue back in 2004.
Go into any inner-city neighborhood, and folks will tell you that government alone can't teach our kids to learn. They know that parents have to teach, that children can't achieve unless we raise their expectations and turn off the television sets and eradicate the slander that says a black youth with a book is acting white. They know those things.
All right, now let's listen to what Bernard Rogers said about how he was treated when he told his friends that he wanted to be a first-generation college student.
When I initially came out of middle school, a lot of people don't know this about me, but, you know, I was a student who was kind of bullied a little bit and who was sometimes persecuted for my clear thought on wanting to be successful and genuinely learning to love school.
So you got picked on for outwardly showing that you wanted to be smart?
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly. Wow. So at such a young age, having that, and I wasn't perfect at any means. Please don't take it as me saying that I was perfect. I wasn't. But I just knew that for where I wanted to get in my life, I needed education. And even though I didn't know where it would take me or how it would take me there, I knew it was important. So, you know, that's a side of me that a lot of people don't know, that I got picked on and I got teased. But those things kind of helped me to understand the very place that I'm in now. I mean, it's the reason why I'm always happy and I go through things just like everybody else. But what I've learned is that intention drives action. So for me, the energy that I bring to my life is going to ultimately get me to the place that I want to be.
Did you ever have a moment when you were bullied or picked on that you thought, maybe I should be a little more reserved, maybe I shouldn't put my hand up in class, that kind of stuff?
Oh, of course. And it led me to sometimes do things that I shouldn't have done. So the one thing that I can think of right now, I remember one time I was feeling so bad for always just trying to do the right thing that one of my friends got me to skip a class. But I remember we were walking around the hall and I skipped the class. And I remember the whole time I felt so bad that I skipped the class, but I was trying to play it off. And I ended up speaking up like towards the middle of that. And I just asked him, I was like, is this what you do? Like when you skip classes, like, is this what you do? You just walk around the halls with nothing to do and this is it? Like, I thought it was like this grand experience because a couple of kids did it and it wasn't fun at all. And I think that was the early onset to me learning how to find my voice and learning how to say, this isn't what I want to do and it isn't helping me and it isn't helping you. So I'm going to do what I want.
How old were you?
I think at that time that was like eighth grade. So I had to be no more than maybe
12 or 13,
something like that. Yeah.
Wow. But you said, I don't care if this makes me less cool in your eyes. I'm going back to class.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a good foundation. I had a really, really, really great foundation with my parents.
Next, let's turn to a conversation that I think we can all relate to, frustration at the doctor's office. At some point, you've probably felt rushed with a doctor, or maybe you felt like you always talked to other staff, but not the actual doctor. And when the doctor finally walks in the room, there's pressure.
Well, Dr. Ron Epstein wrote a book called Attending: Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. He's known around the world for his writing about the value of making patients more comfortable. Some doctors argue that due to the current medical system, there's not much they can do. They've got to deal with dozens of patients a day. But here's where Dr. Epstein says that's wrong.
We have too many strictures. That's very clear. But the question is, I think it's really important to make changes in the regulatory climate and the way that the documentation requirements, the things that take physicians away from face-to-face contact with patients, that's essential. But what do we do in the interim? And I've been in many countries and experienced healthcare in many places, and I've yet to find a place that's perfect. I mean, they're all fighting some of the same issues. And so the question is, what do we do in the circumstance that we have? How do you make the time that you have count the most? I also do a lot of research on communication between doctors and patients, and I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of audio recordings of doctor-patient visits. And I'll tell you, you know, some doctors, even with very short amounts of time, use the time exquisitely well, and some people have much more time and seem to never really quite get to the point. So part of it is learning to be a good communicator, but part of it is learning to attend to the right things. Even simple things like sitting down, patients will feel that you're more present, and you'll feel yourself more present than if you're standing. I mean, hospital rounds, very often people stand. I bring a chair into the room. I spend the same amount of time as a colleague, but I do spend some time. I make a point of spending the first 2 minutes of any patient visit in the hospital, in my office, face to face with the patient and not looking at a screen. Now, you'd think that that would slow me down, but in fact, it speeds me up because I don't have to ask the same question twice. When I hear the answer, it kind of sticks with me. And when I'm able to do that and really be present, it makes me more effective and more efficient at the same time. And I think that's teachable.
We have a call on exactly this subject. So David in Pittsford will help us as well with this. Go ahead, David.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question, I'd like the doctor's feedback on this, is that most doctor's office, unless you're a single doctor with your own practice, if you're in a practice that's run by the U of R or really anybody else, the doctors really must see 20, 25 patients a day. That's what they're being managed to see, which makes it difficult for them to spend a lot of time with their patients. I'm wondering what his comments are. And the reality is that the doctors are being managed to that metric. So where do we go from here?
All right, David,
thank you.
David, thank you. One of the things I'm hearing from Dr. Epstein is it's more time would be great, but it's spending time more wisely and with more attentiveness to begin with the time you have. Is 20 to 25 an accurate number on patients a day?
You know, some people see more depending on specialty. Some people see less. It just really depends. But I think for a family doctor, that's probably pretty close to it, sometimes more. I think it really involves just those micro decisions that you make moment to moment about how to use your time most effectively. You know, sometimes you feel that nothing would be enough, and there are always constraints. But I would say when I'm practicing at my best, patients don't feel rushed, even though the time might be short. When I'm practicing at my worst, then we all feel harried and hurried. So I think it's possible to cultivate a quality of attention that leaves people feeling heard, which is often the main reason people come to the doctor in the first place.
To feel heard.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, if you ask people, you know, what their expectations are for a doctor visit, at least in primary care, many people are expecting a cure for whatever problem they have. But a lot of people come in just to have their problem legitimated, just to say this is a real problem and have someone else acknowledge it.
Next up, the story of a boy with the wrong body parts. That's how Bennett Wallace described himself in a conversation about why he wanted to transition. He's a transgender male and is at the center of a new documentary called Real Boy.
Ben was in Rochester to help promote the film. We'll start with a clip from the film Real Boy. Bennett is talking to his mother, trying to explain what transgender means. His mother is having a hard time accepting the concept.
This is how I'm going to explain it. I am literally a boy with the wrong body parts.
No, I just think, you know, that there is the argument of you're not.
I just don't get
it. I think it goes back to what defines what is a boy. Is it your brain or is it your body? In our hearts, you're Rachel. That's what we've known you as, and that's a hard habit to break. What's so wrong with the opinion of you are who you are and you get what you get? And
Is that why you got plastic surgery? Very minor plastic surgery. Enhancing what you have, is that all right with you? Where do you draw the line? You get what you get. Stop getting haircuts and hair dye. Stop piercing your ears. Stop putting on makeup. Like, what I have is a body that doesn't fit.
Your mother is raising these questions because, clearly to me, she loves you.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't get it at the moment. Now, I don't think it's a spoiler alert to say there's a lot of evolution and progress that mm-hmm. happens, but I still think it's really valuable to see it. I think viewers are going to walk away from this film with a lot of admiration, don't you?
I do. I mean, that seems to be the consensus so far.
Sometimes we meet people who are going through transition, or especially if people in your mom's shoes, and people who are not parents but don't really understand transgender transition, and you haven't had their lived experience. But giving these glimpses into your childhood, I kind of look back and I'm like, oh, I was always looking at a boy. You know, it made sense to me, I guess.
It's the context that I think is really helpful for people, because there's a lot of assumptions made when somebody comes out as transgender about them or about their experiences, and you only see this tiny aspect of their life. But I do think that the context is really helpful for a lot of people to see, oh, wow, Ben has been, you know, this person since he was little. It's obvious. It's in the home movies.
I was just really gratified that it was there just for that context. When do you remember thinking about it? Thinking about, you know, sort of that kind of identity question. Mm-hmm.
That's such an interesting question, because I think when you're like first experiencing gender as a little child, like, we don't have words like transgender, or, you know, they weren't taught to me back then. They certainly weren't mainstream. And so my first memories with gender are realizing that I wasn't like other boys. Like, it's not actually, oh, I think I'm a boy. It was like, oh, I'm not like all my other friends, you know. And it wasn't until later in my teen years, when I learned the language and developed a community, that I came out as trans.
Ben, and I also want to ask you about a question that I'm sure comes up for a lot of, especially trans teenagers going through this, which is, you know, especially transition in the direction you went, you know, and the question is, well, are you just a tomboy? You know, that kind of a question versus, you know, you're saying, look, I'm a boy. You know, that's what I am. That's what my identity is. Do people question that? Do they put that question out there, even in a loving way? Does that come up?
That's how Real Boy started. Yeah. You know, Real Boy was an affirmation that I gave myself when I was younger, when I was 18, because I was tired of this idea that I was really the gender I was assigned at birth. You know, like, I think that we need to trust people more when they tell us who they are. And, you know, identity is complicated and it's very personal, and everybody's experiences, like, you can't just draw parallels. I mean, we can all, you know, there's universal things that we can relate to each other all, and I think that's what we should focus on, because the rest of it is just personal.
Let's close with a conversation about the upcoming solar eclipse. On August 21st, there will be a total solar eclipse.
And you won't be able to see the entire thing in Rochester, but a lot of the country will have a chance to see it. The path of the total eclipse will be from roughly the northwest down to the southeast. We talked to RIT's Brian Koberline and Roger Duby about why this event will be so remarkable.
It's a big tourist event. And the thing is if you're thinking about seeing the eclipse, The key is you have to be in the path of totality, where the moon completely covers the sun. So here, I think it's going to be about 70%. That's an interesting thing, but it's not an eclipse.
But can I ask, like, what 70%, what did that look like?
That the moon will cover 70% of the sun.
But so how many, I mean, like, will we have 30% light, or will it just be kind of a...
It will get darker. Okay. There will be a weirdness to the shadows, because you get what's known as a pinhole effect. And basically, the sun will be shown as kind of a crescent. It'll look, you know, just like a crescent, because the moon is blocking part of it.
Okay.
So that's all fine and good, but that's not totality. So if you haven't been in a total eclipse, you haven't seen an eclipse. It's radically different. Even at 90%,
you look like you're starting
thing.
To get really excited.
I'm pretty jazzed about this.
You're
this
going.
I am definitely going.
We're going to have a swath of this country that goes across many states that's going to be just tourist haven for an eclipse that will last how long? 2 minutes?
2 minutes, a minute and a half, depending on where you are in the country.
Totality is very short.
Yeah.
2 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But for those of us who have not been in a totality of an eclipse before, you know, are we envision it looking like nighttime? All of a sudden, sun's gone. You can see the stars in the middle of the afternoon.
It's one of those things that's hard to describe. And I have to say that, you know, I haven't been in a total eclipse, so I've only heard about the total eclipse. But it does get dark enough to see stars during the day. There is a whole shadowing effect leading up to the eclipse. You can see the reflections of light near the horizon, because it's still sunny near the horizon, away from where you are at totality. So it's kind of bright all around you and dark where you are. You can see things like the chromosphere and possibly the corona, but probably just the chronosphere. But these effects are something that we're just not used to seeing. we can't even wrap our heads around it. There's reports of people who just kind of lose their heads over this. And they just can't wrap their heads around it.
Brian was telling me before the hour began some of these stories. People will kind of lose their mind.
They lose their mind. So there's this, I it may be on YouTube, but there's this video of this woman that during the total eclipse, she's screaming at the top of her lungs, pounding on the back of her husband, just completely out of her head. And she remembers nothing of this because it in some sense, it breaks your head.
That's a very convenient excuse, by the way.
Well, you know, I haven't talked to her. I don't know what she was really thinking. But there is this thing of, you know, people talk about, well, I think I may have seen an eclipse. No, if you think you may have seen an eclipse, you didn't see an eclipse. A total eclipse is something that you always remember. For your entire life, you will remember. I remember when I saw this.
And so you're going to Southern Illinois, but what if you get a bad forecast? I mean, are people going to drive if they've got a cloudy forecast?
I'm looking at the forecast like a hawk, okay. And I'm driving wherever it's clear.
Because you do want clear skies for this.
Yes. Yeah. A cloudy sky, it's just going to go dark. You're not going to see the effect in the same way.
Okay. All right. Wow. So that is August 21st, 2017. If you have not made plans yet, you may be out of luck, but, you know, unless you've got someone to stay with.
Well, the other thing you could do is that if you can't get a room in totality, you can look for rooms, say, an hour or 2 hours away from totality.
Drive to the path?
And then drive to the path early in the morning. Okay. There's going to be weird traffic, so expect there to be traffic, but you could get lodging somewhere in the area.
Roger and I are just going to wait, what, 7 years? What's the deal?
7 years. The great news is that the other choice is to wait 7 years and then a total eclipse passes right over Rochester. So now we can be charging $800
yes.
per night for a room.
Yes. Start booking now.
Exactly.
2024 is the next eclipse, and Rochester is in the path.
Correct.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can catch Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.